the center of Tolda, and covers a lot of different areas, but mainly the issue of the relationship between Yaakov and Esav. And what I'm really, because in this Sedra, who would you say is the main character in the Sedra? It's very difficult. That's a subjective judgment. I don't mean there's any objective answer over here, but who would you depict as the main character, the main actor in this Sedra? In certain Sedras, it's clear. You know, Avram, Lech Lecha, when he leaves the land, Avram is the main actor. In certain cases, Yosef is the main. In certain cases, Moshe Rabbeinu. Here it's not clear. There's a lot of different... Asa. It seems to me, though, that who's really controlling what's going on over here? Yeah, behind the scenes, Rivka. Rivka is operating, and this is very much in line with the shiur that I gave about the different roles of men and women. Rivka is really pulling all the strings over here. She's exerting a tremendous amount of control, though she's basically really behind the scenes. So I want to focus to a large extent on the activities of Rivka as a means of elucidating what's going on. Now, let's begin with some questions. Let's take a look at the latter part of the Sedra. And the latter part of the Sedra, that's right after the brachos. Right? I'm going to be going up back a lot, so it says 27:41, after the brachos, and Esav realized he's been deceived, so it says that Esav hated Yaakov because of the bracha that God had blessed his father. I should have seen that his father had blessed him. And Esav said in his heart, I'll wait till the days of the mourning of my father, in other words, we'll wait till Yisro dies, and I'll kill my brother Yaakov. Okay, so he reached a decision that he wanted to kill him for what he did. And it was told to Rivka the words of Esav, her elder son. Alright, so it's not really clear, because it doesn't say that Esav told anyone. So, what does this mean? I'm not going to make a major point there. Rashi says she knew it was Ruach HaKodesh, with the Holy Spirit, which means basically prophecy. But that she understood it very well. But it's not, I think there was more over here than an understanding, because you see, it says that it was told to her the words, and she called Yaakov, her younger son, and said to him, behold, your brother Esav is planning to kill you. So she seemed pretty definite about it. She wasn't doubtful. The only other way to understand it is, Rashi explains that she knew it from her Kurdish. I imagine that you could assume that she found out about it, because it's in the nature of a person, especially a person like Esav, that he makes known. Because he's the reason why he was filled with anger. He was in a state of frustration. He was angry at him. And on the other hand, he couldn't do anything at the moment because of the fear of his father. You see, he still retained, even though he was a wicked person, he still retained a certain fear, more than just a fear, a practical fear, but a certain respect. He needed the approval of his father and Abraham. So it could be that he just, it's hard for a person to keep speaking. If the person doesn't verbalize it, Freud once said that if you know how to read people, you will see that it's impossible for them to keep speaking. Even if they don't verbalize it, they'll express it by one way or another way, indirectly through a slip. People are punished. So it could be that she found out about it. But that's not really the main issue. She knew about it, and for the grace, she's concerned. And she said, I would imagine she knew for sure, because she would not have sent away and been parted from Yaakov and had Yaakov part from the family for such a long period of time unless she was sure. So she says, now my son, listen to my voice and get up and run away to my brother Laban. And you will dwell with him for a certain amount, you know, for a period of days or years, whatever it may be. But see, the way she depicted, she imagined it's going to be a short period of time. It did not turn out that way. Because it was, I believe, about 36 years. 14 years he learned by Shem and Aver, and then 22 years he worked for Laban. So his return was at least 36 years. So it was longer than she anticipated. Here's the reason, because she believed that the anger would die down. that this is a momentary reaction until the anger dies down, and he'll forget what you did to him, and I'll censor you and take you from there. Why should I be what is the term of a okay why should I be bereft of both of you in one day? So it makes sense. So she is aware of Asaph's plans, and in response she sends Yaakov away. She tells Yaakov though the truth. Then Rivka said to Yitzchak, now she speaks to Yitzchak because she has to talk to Yitzchak, her husband and her father. She says that I'm disgusted with my life due to these daughters of Chet, the daughters that Asaph had taken. And you know, because I'll say, the rabbis say that they were engaged in idolatry and so forth, and it was repulsive to both of them. And these women are repulsive. If Yaakov would take a woman from the daughters of Chet as these, I have no reason to live. I don't want to live. Then Yitzchak calls to Yaakov and blesses him and commands him and says, do not take a wife from the daughters of Canaan. Go to Padan Aram, the house of Suel, the brothers. So he winds up sending Yaakov to the exact same place, but for a different reason. And take a wife from there, from the daughters of Laban. He was instructed to look amongst the daughters of Laban for a wife. Okay. Excuse me. And then he goes on. You know, he blesses him and so forth. What? In other words, there were two reasons then. It turns out that there are two reasons why it's a good idea for Yaakov to go to Laban. Two reasons. One is because he's in danger of being killed by Esau. The other reason is that he needs a wife, and apparently the girls of Canaan were not fitting for a wife, and that's the place to go for a wife. Of these two reasons, the essential, the most significant one would be the one that he's in danger. And that's the reason that he could have told Yaakov just to go there for a wife. Why didn't he tell you such a true reason? What you omit? And it seems to be there's no lie in Bavo D.C., but it seems to be, what would the term be for that? Why is she dodging the issue? Why isn't she telling him the truth? This is the main reason. You don't need this whole story about the fact that these women aren't good. That's not an essential thing. In fact, it even strategically, it's not even the best thing to do, because it invites a rebuttal. Just like he was not permitted to leave the land, perhaps he might not like the idea of Yaakov leaving the land just to look for a wife. It does leave open, although she must have felt it was compelling. She must have felt it was compelling, and he'd agree. But it does leave open some possibility of a rebuttal. However, the other reason, first of all, it's the truth. The father should know that his son is in danger, Esau is planning to kill him, just like she knows, and just like Yaakov has to know. He didn't have to tell Yaakov either, but Yaakov has to know. So that's my first question. Why she does not tell Yitzchak the true reason and relies upon the subterfuge. Now, the second question, I want to get back to the basic idea of the story, as Lori pointed out before, with regard to the difference between Yaakov and Esau. So there were major differences, as you know. Yaakov was a tzaddik, Yaakov Ishtam Yoshev Olam. And Esav was it doesn't say he was a Russia, it says he was a Ishtada, a day of diet, it says he was a hunter and all, but as you know, he was an individual who was a Russia, who wasn't fit for the bracha. And he was able to deceive Yitzchak, but he wasn't able to deceive Rivka. So that's what I want to focus in on now. That's a very big question. How is it possible? Why is it, in other words, that Rivka was able to see the true nature of Esav? They both had the same phenomena to witness. How is it that she knew the truth, and that Yitzchak made a very, very serious mistake? That's the question. A very serious mistake. So I want to know a number of things. First of all, was this a defect in him? Because the essence of the Avos was their perfection, and their perfection entailed their tremendous chachma. And chachma per se is not sufficient. One has to have moral perfection. But The whole foundation of their perfection was their great wisdom. They were they were all on the level of a high level of prophecy, extremely wise men. So Yitzchak, it seems like a defect. He's made a major mistake. That's a very serious mistake, especially when you're a leader of a people, to simply misread some individual and believe that this person could be fooled into believing that a person is really a Rasha in a major way is a tzaddik. I just want to state the question. We'll come back to that. So was it a defect or wasn't it a defect? And what exactly was Yitzchak's concept of Esau? Because he deemed him worthy of the brachos. He was going to give him the brachos. So he must have had a certain concept. He must have seen the same things that Rivka saw, and he must have interpreted everything in a different way. So I just want to know what his interpretation was, as opposed to her interpretation. I want to know why, if we can figure that out. But I'll give you a chance to, give you a read. I just want to state the question. All right? Now, I have another question. Let me give you an opportunity to anticipate. Given that Rivka was convinced that he was making a mistake when she heard about the plan to give him the bracha, so you know what she did. You know, she relied on subterfuge. Again, she relies on subterfuge. And she told him to pretend that he was Esau. Because she had overheard the conversation. She knew he was instructed to go on the hunt and get a tasty meal and so forth, prepared to put me in the right frame of mind to pronounce the bracha, the blessings upon you. So she overheard this, and she then went ahead and instructed Yaakov to pretend that he was Esau, to basically try and fool him, a charade, to dress up, she dressed him in the garments that Esau would wear, and she prepared the food and so forth. And you know that Yaakov was very reluctant. He was worried about this, because he says that perhaps my father will touch me. He was very reluctant, he was very hesitant. And then he even says that he'll find out, and I'll become like a charlatan in his eyes, a phony, and he'll curse me. So he was very worried about this whole thing. And Rivka assures him, don't worry, I'll lie to Lost Club and Eve. Whatever curse, if there should be a curse, it'll come on me, not on you. So she manages to achieve what she wants to achieve by this indirect method. Is there any question that you'd like to ask on that? Anything strange about that? Her behavior. My question is, yeah. In other words, why didn't she go to Yitzchak directly? That would have made sense. And tell him, confront him with the fact that he's making a serious mistake. It certainly seems like a wise course. And I thought, Malki's example is perfect. What did Sarah do when she disagreed? When she was convinced that Yishmael was dangerous for a bad influence to Yitzchak. So she goes to Avram directly and says, Garesh Allah goes to Yitzchak, to drive out this maiden and her son, to drive out Yishmael, get rid of him, he's a bad influence. And she said, so openly, directly. She didn't try and, plan any kind of sneaky methods to get rid of him. It was go straight to Avram. And Avram didn't agree with her. The thing was bad in his eyes. And then God intervened. God spoke to him and said, Kol Shetama Lecho Sarah Shema B'Kola. Sarah's right. Whatever Sarah says, listen to her. She's got the correct insight into the situation. That should be the model. Why couldn't she go? And I don't think it's sufficient to merely say that they didn't have that there was something wrong in the marriage relationship, or they didn't have the kind of relationship where you can communicate. I don't think so at all. Later on, when she wants to communicate about the wives, the issue about the wives, and I don't think it's a good idea for him to marry one of these girls, she goes right to the point, and Yitzchak listens and accepts it. And Yitzchak is a tzaddik. I don't believe that Yitzchak would have any problem listening to the truth from his wife. We've established that the Avos have tremendous respect, the wives to the husbands, and vice versa. I mean, he's a tzaddik. He would certainly welcome any information that she would have to give him. So why? And I'll tell you, she was taking a chance also. Because obviously, the dispensation of the brachos was an extremely important thing. Who should get the brachos? We're not going to really get into it that much today, but these brachas were of tremendous significance and importance in terms of the future of the nation. This is a crucial stage, and for the brachas to be given to the wrong individual would have been a calamity for the future of Klal Yisrael. So she was engaged in something which was extremely important, and she was totally convinced. She had to be absolutely convinced that she was right about Esau. So why would she go about it in a manner which would be taking a risk? After all, there was a risk, there was a chance over there that it wouldn't succeed, which she herself admitted. Because Yaakov, it's not just a question of the curse. Forget about the curse, she's willing to take the curse. But there is the implicit idea that it might fail. And if it fails, then Esau will get the bracha. So why not take the method which is most likely to succeed? First of all, you should go and be direct, be open and be honest, and go straight and don't. Even though we say that the lie is permitted, it was permitted to Yaakov to lie in the situation. If there are situations in which it's permitted to lie. Yeah, but if there's another alternative, there's also a question. We have a problem, how could Yaakov lie? So, that could be justified. The Gemara talks about situations where it's permitted to lie. And obviously, this situation would have caused great harm. But that's only assuming that there's no other way to go. If there is another way to go, why choose? So that's my next question. You're dealing with the most intelligent people. They knew their level. She knew her level. She was very confident about her intelligence and her knowledge. You can be sure that Yitzchak knew her level. And Avraham knew Sarah's level. He disagreed with her in the case of Yishmael. It doesn't mean he has to leave, but he knew her level. That strengthens the question. Take a look at the story of the blessing that Jackie was just alluding to. This is in chapter 27, about Pasuk Lamed 30 and 31. And after Yaakov comes in and he questions, and he gives him the bracha. And then right, as soon as he leaves, Esav comes in. And he realizes that something is wrong. And take a look at Lamed Beis. Yitzchak said, "Who are you?" And he said, "I am your Bincha Bechorcha Esav. I'm your firstborn son Esav." Then take a look at verse 33. And Yitzchak trembled, the mighty trembling. And he said, "Who is this one who hunted, went out to the hunt, and brought me, and I ate from everything before I blessed him? Gam Baruch Yeh. He is also blessed." Now, what's strange about the reaction? What was his charada gadola? What was his tremendous trembling? Why did he go? In other words, at that moment, he realized two things: that he had made a mistake. He had made a mistake. He had given the brachos to Yaakov, who was not the Bechor, and that once he had given the brachos, that's the way it had to be. There was nothing he could do about it because he tells him. He says, Baruch Hashem explains him, there's nothing I can do. The basic idea, without going into it, the basic idea is that these brachos had to be recited by Yitzchak. Baruch HaKadosh. They were recited with the spirit of prophecy. That was God's will. And that once they were given, Yitzchak knew that the dispensation of these brachos had to be through him. Now, well, I'm not going into why, because God should have chosen a different method. But it was God's will, and that's the whole idea, that's the premise of the story. That Yitzchak would be the one to be the dispenser of these brachos. And that once these brachos were dispensed, whoever received them, it was Yitzchak's obligation to give them to the one who he saw fit. But once they were given by him, that's it. They could not be rescinded. They could not be rescinded. So that, of course, that's why it was important. I mean, as you see, Rivka couldn't just leave the situation as it was. I mean, if the brachos would have been received by Esav, even though he was not fit, they would have been his. And once the brachos were given to Yaakov, then he could not rescind them. So what was the reaction of trembling over here? I'd like to try and explain that. Okay, but let's get back now. Let's get back to the... We have a number of questions out here on the floor. Let's see. The major question, I believe, around which everything focuses, is the first question I asked pertaining to how Rivka and Yitzchak perceived Esau. I said, what was the difference in their views of the two, and why? Why is it that what was lacking in Yitzchak that he was mistaken? The truth of the matter is that he was mistaken, made a serious mistake. Okay, Elori describes the different reactions. It says, "Vayigdalu hanarim." The boys grew up. The children grew up. The Rashi says that as long as they were children, you couldn't tell the difference. You know, which one was the righteous one, which one was not. But once they grew up, then it became apparent. The character became apparent. The whole idea that even in pregnancy, that the Rashi says that when they passed by the Beit Medrash Yaakov move, and when they passed by the Avodah Zarah, the church, Esau was moved. That obviously is not meant to be taken literally. It doesn't mean that they were, that God determined from birth that this one was a tzaddik, this one was a rasha. That can't be, because we don't believe in that. Nobody is either a tzaddik or a rasha by nature. And it just means to say that each individual has a different kind of a disposition, but that since we believe in bechira, he has the capacity. That is to say that that's right. So therefore, the fact is that by nature they were very different, and each one had to overcome the defect of his nature and perfect himself. Yaakov was an ish tam yoshev ha'olam. By nature, tam means he was very innocent, right, and very pure, maybe naive. Yoshev ha'olam, he gravitated towards the tent. Now that's very good, but in certain situations, yeah, he was very naive as to the ways of the world, how to deal with the tricky situations that the world throws at you. Now, in order to be the leader, he had to overcome a lot of factors within himself. And that's why he was subjected, more than any of the others, to all the different... He faced more challenges and problems stemming from interactions with people. He had Lavan and Esav with his children. And he had to confront every imaginable situation. That's why Chazal say, Masri Avos Simon Labanim. I mean, the one to study the most, in terms of practical application of practical knowledge, is Yaakov. Yaakov encountered all the situations that we have to encounter. But Esav was not a Rasha by nature. It just means that he's particularly instinctual. He was a hunter. He had more powerful needs, physical needs, aggressive needs, and so forth. That doesn't make him into a Rasha, because Chazal say that you should serve God with the Yetzer Hara as well. You take the energy. The mind is such that it can has the power to overcome the instincts. And if you recognize what the true good is, then you have to look at your own nature. See, a person's very important idea. And we get down to the personal. A person, he very often, I mean, it's good. We always follow certain models. We have to have role models, so to speak. You know, great people, truly great people. Of course, you have to know who is really worthy of being followed. A gedolim. This is used in the schools to a great extent. You know, read the books about the gedolim, you know, men and women. And to a certain extent, it's very positive, but you have to be careful about this, because there is a tendency, you find it in a lot of the yeshivas, where you'll model yourself. You'll model yourself after someone who you really don't have the capacity to be like. There are many different ways that a person can serve God. Now, you read the stories about Rav Moshe, for example. It comes to mind, not just his great genius, but what a tremendous tzaddik he was. And basically, well, in the way the world understands it, totally selfless, devoted, you know, to Torah, to helping others. You know, hardly ever getting angry or whatever. I mean, you know, his needs in the physical are just minute. Now, that is good. That's inspirational. And, you know, it has an effect upon you. I think it has an effect upon you. When you read about such a person, it does have a good effect upon you. But the downside is when, you know, people read how when he was 15 years old, he would be studying 18 hours a day. And then you try and be like him and try and, you know, you try and be the exact same way. It can lead to tremendous problems and depression, because that's not you. So you're supposed to operate with your own nature. Each person has to have the capacity to recognize his own nature and to perfect his own nature. So there's different paths, and not everybody is going to be the Gadol Hador. Not everybody that studies Torah is going to be a Gadol Hador, or even someone who's a full-time Torah scholar. there's going to be a businessman. And he too, in his own framework, if he, that's the machzor zulam b'teisecha, the yisachar and zavulam. The machzor zulam b'teisecha. The joy zavulam, two shvatim, zavulam and yisachar. Zavulam went out and did commerce and business, and of course they studied Torah. But their major contribution to the perpetuation of the Ummah was to study Torah, and therefore they were perfected, but they created the wealth, and they supplied the money that they had to Yisachar. The Yisachar, the Alalecha. And they were more designed towards staying in the tents, being the teachers, and studying Torah. So each person has to work within his own nature. And that's a very important thing for parents to recognize. Because, you know, that's the way our society is, very, very competitive, and you know, getting the top grades and getting into the best schools and so forth, and or a certain mold, being a professional. You must be a professional. It could be a doctor or this or that, but and not everybody's geared. There's different paths towards fulfilling your identity as a Tzelemol Kim. I think it's very important for a person to get to know his own nature, and to know, not to repress, but to know his own emotions, and to know how to best deal with those emotions, what suits him the best at a certain point. Where would he be most fulfilled and make the greatest contribution? Of course, everything within the framework of Torah. That gives us an insight. That's why Esav was not predetermined at all to be a Rashi. He had free will to be a Tzadik Gomer. And if he was predetermined as a child to be a Rashi, Yitzchak would have known him. There wouldn't have been any question. So what happened, it says, one second, Vayi Esav ish yodei tzayed ish tzada. His nature was to be a man of the hunt, a man of the field. The Yaakov ish tam. Yaakov was a innocent, or simple, but not me. Not, yeah, innocent. Innocent is good. Ish tam was innocent, was simple. In other words, I think it means plain and ordinary, in the sense that he didn't have these tremendous drives lacking. Although Rashi says tam, Rashi takes tam to mean a certain naivete, not into the world. He is content. He was apart from the world, moderate, and it implies all these things. Yoshev Oholim. So then the next part is Vayav Yitzchak is Esav, and Yitzchak loved Esav, Tzayed the fifth, because the Tzayed, the hunt, was in his mouth. And this is a very, very interesting pasuk, meaningful pasuk. The Rivka Ohevet is Yaakov, and Rivka loved Yaakov. So why is funny? Yitzchak loved Esav because of the hunt. Well, the hunt in his mouth literally means in the mouth of Yitzchak, he would hunt and he'd give him food. But you know, Chazal say that Tzayed b'Siv, the Tzayed, the hunt, was in the mouth of Esav. Esav knew how to deceive him with words. He used to play games with him. Okay, and Rivka loved Yaakov. Rivka apparently didn't love Yaakov. Rivka did not love Esav apparently. So what is this? What is this? Malki, when Yitzchak sends him away, it says the Kel Shakai Yivarech Osa. When he sends him away to find a wife, as far as he knows, Vidlecha is Birkas Avraham, and then he gives you the Birkas Avraham, Lachol Zarcha Itach, to you and your children after, or the Lerishtecha as Eretz Megarecha, to inherit the land of your dwelling, Ashenosan Elokim LeAvraham, which means to say the Yerushas Haaretz, that bracha is given to who? To Yaakov. So the brachas that Yaakov, so to speak, stole from Esav are not the same. Those were the brachas of Mital HaShemayim, the brachas of material success, material wealth. And that Yitzchak intended to give to Esav. However, the bracha of being the spiritual leader of the future of Klal Yisrael, and the one who would be inheriting that position, and inheriting the land, that was clearly Yaakov. We see from that pasuk, the Birkas Avraham is the brachos of the spiritual Torah, to be the spiritual leader. That Yaakov did not have to use any kind of deception for. Because he knew that Yaakov was Ishtam Yoshev Ha'olam. He knew that the true Torah scholar was Yaakov. So there was no doubt, it wasn't that he had made a mistake about Yaakov. He made a mistake about Esau. He never imagined Esav to be in that position. bear in mind that the only mistake he made was with regard to who the material blessing should be given to. All right? That's an important factor. Yeah?
Well,
I Rashi. See, Rashi says, Yodea Tzayit, knew how to hunt. Lossud will aramas his others to fish. Esav knew how to hunt and to deceive his father with his mouth. The Sholo, and he would ask him, Abba, hechma asana tamela, if a tevin. Father, how do we give miser, a tithe? How do you tithe salt and straw? Kasavar Ovid, shumadakdek mitzvah. His father thought that he's very concerned how precise he is with mitzvah. That tells you, that illustration, it tells you a great deal. And later on, Rashi decided the fiv, right? The hunt, the food was in his mouth. The plain shot is in the mouth of Yitzchak. The Medrash says in the mouth of Esav. Shehayitzado, so he would like hunt him. He was like a hunter, and he would deceive him with his words. So what's understand? What was Yitzchak's conception? See, I think in these two psukim, these two personalities reflect what we mentioned before. That Yitzchak did not expect that everybody is going to be the Yoshev Olam. Yaakov was the Talmud Chacham by nature. He's the one who didn't learn the whole time. That's his nature. That's his essence. So it says, of course he loves him. The Pasuk doesn't have to point that out. How can he not love Yaakov? The Pasuk is pointing out that he loved Esav too. He loved Esav too. Because, see, there's a need for both personalities. There's a need for the one who's Yoshev Olam, who dwells in the tent. And then there's a need for the one who's your day of Friday, the Shudder. That's another personality. That's part of the plan of God, that we should go out and conquer the world. That's the world of conquering in the sense, in the proper sense, to try and foster the development of civilization and building of societies and the progress in terms of science. That's the man of the field. He was a builder of societies. He was a great man, Abel. Now that's a legitimate involvement as well. Not everybody is going to be the Talmud Chacham when the society was set up. As I said, Samach Zvulun B'Tzeisecha, rejoice. That as long as a person is operating for the proper motivation, if his nature is to be a conqueror, to be a businessman, to be a builder, that's a wonderful thing. Provided, of course, his values are the values of Torah. So he's using his talents in business in order to achieve the proper ideal. So that's a wonderful thing. And he will love the parent who identifies with the true ideals of Torah will love his child as much. He's not going to love the one who's a Torah scholar more. And it's not even true to say that the one who's the Yoshev Olam is even more perfected. You can't say he's more perfected. Perfection is measured with regard to the nature of the individual. So an individual who has a talent and to do business and he learns Torah, And he perfects himself, and he applies ethics and morality in his business dealings, and helps people and builds Torah through that medium, is as perfected as the individual who's been studying the whole time. We don't measure perfection by the amount of hours you put into studying Torah. That, I believe, how Yitzchak looked. That's why Vayav. He thought that Esav was the true man of the field in terms of Torah. But that he was different than Yaakov, because Yaakov didn't have a need for the materialism. Yaakov was Yoshi, he was content. Tent signifies the minimal in terms of the materialism. But Esav was a man who needed these materialistic pursuits. He liked the hunt, he needed the physical enjoyment. But given, granted, that he would have all of these things, he would use them for the true purpose. How did he manage to achieve this? How did he manage to get? Esav was extremely shrewd. That's the shrewdness of the sukkim elucidus, the shrewdness of the hunter. But he was a hunter with regard to Yitzchak. He understood exactly what Yitzchak's philosophy was, what he would expect, and he knew exactly how to cater to that image, how to create a certain image. Because he covered his tracks very well. And I've seen people do this kind of thing. If you're in yeshiva, you can see this. There are people who know, because you're not with the person all the time. And if you're not an extremely suspicious person, you're not suspicious, and you have a certain inclination to look for the good in people, then it's very easy. You can be fooled because the person knows exactly how to set it up, and it appears very natural. Like every time, I've seen students do this, could be with myself, could be with, more often it's with Rabbi Chase, that they're looking for the approval. They're looking for the approval. So then they can be wasting their time, they could be bottling and so forth, yet every time they'll notice Rabbi Chase, they'll run over to him with a question, to Shiloh. Thus giving the impression they've been working on, I'm glad you just came in. I've been working on this thing all night. You know, you drop a few little words here and there. Now, let's assume it's Rabbi Chase, and he doesn't see what they're doing. He's not with them all night long, and he may not see what they're doing, you know, when he's not around. It creates, you sort of plant the seed. Well, with a certain image, wow, this guy's unbelievable. He's always involved in this, that, and he may not even think consciously, but it leaves him with the impression this person is always, by day he's learning this, by night he's learning that, and there, suffice it to say, I think you know what I'm talking about, but there's many ways, provided if you don't have to be with a person all the time, that's why, as they say, you don't really know a person until you live with them. And I'm sure you've seen the truth of the matter is even amongst ourselves, you don't really know another person. Because just think of that, when you live with the person, the only person that really knows another person is the one who's living with them, I guess, the spouse or whatever, the members of the family. You can't really fool the members of your family that well. Of course, Yitzchak was a smarter, but he was, don't assume that Yitzchak didn't spend the whole 24 hours with him. He was out in the field. Yitzchak was sitting and learning. So, if that's the case, he created a perfect image. He never did anything that would cause him to have a negative image of him. He practiced Kibbutz. Because I'll say, if you want to know how to practice Kibbutz, follow the example of Asaph, because Asaph went to extreme. He would wear special clothing, and he would do everything perfectly. And whenever the whole communication would be about something pertaining to halacha, or something pertaining to perfection. So therefore, he created, but if he could not hide the fact that he was a hunter, he didn't try and see which one. He didn't try and pretend he's another Yaakov, because that he couldn't do. There's no way. Oh, but he can be the hunter who was doing everything. He's out there building a business and building and working in the world of creativity in order to achieve the true end. So that is why Yitzchak loved him. Yitzchak loved him because he thought that though he's different than Yaakov, he has different needs. As a matter of fact, even harder, you could say, for a person like that, to be out there in the field and to have the ability to gain all that materialism and conquest and still to be involved in science. You have even more admiration in people. That was the, in other words, the mistake, by the way, that's why he believes that he should get the physical. Because you give the physical, the material bracha to the one who needs it. He needs these. And he's the best one to entrust it with because he is going to use it for the true purposes. Alright? Now, the question is, why is it that Yitzchak was able to be deceived? Was that a defect? He was deceived. I'm explaining how the deception occurred. But we still have to answer the question, what caused him to be deceived? Was that a defect in him? What caused it? As opposed to Rivka, who was not deceived. How come she was not deceived? Because she witnessed the same thing. And I don't believe that Esau, who was so shrewd, would be stupid enough to show a totally different face. He didn't act differently to his mother. He must have treated her with great respect. So, what happened over here? If you take a look, you may have heard this idea before. But there is, yeah. You see, in other words, the point is that I don't think that Rivka was concerned so much that Yaakov should have it as that Esau should not have it. Because everything, being given all that material wealth, everything was dependent upon the fact that at bottom he wasn't corrupt. If he's corrupt, however, he could destroy the world. So her main concern was that it should not be given. He wanted to make a division between the two. And that he would use this material for the true for her, he would support Torah. But once she knew, of course, what his true nature was, he had no intention of supporting Torah, but rather could use it to destroy Torah, so therefore it had to be taken away from him, and Yaakov had to be entrusted with both. Yeah, it's an important point. Now, the nature of Yitzchak. Now, I believe that Yitzchak's mistake over here was not based upon any what we would call a defect. He was lacking in a certain type of savvy, but that wasn't because of a defect. Take a look at Rashi. He goes to now Chav Vav, 26. And this will explain a lot about Yitzchak. Some of this you might be familiar with. One. And there was a famine in the land, aside from the first famine in the days of Abraham. And Yitzchak went to Abimelech, the king of the Philistines, in Gerar. Now that's still part of Eretz Yisrael, Canaan. And God appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Shchon Baruch Hashem Omer Elecha. Dwell in the land that I will tell you." Means to say, stay Canaan. But God intervenes and explicitly forbids him from leaving the land. But Rashi comments on that. "Do not go down to Egypt," Rashi, for his intention was to go down to Egypt just like his father Abraham had done in the days of famine. God said to him, "Do not go to Egypt, for you are an Ola Tamima. You are a perfect Ola." Now Ola is a carbon, all of which is consumed on the Mizbeach. I'll explain that in a minute. But you are a perfect Ola, carbon Ola. The Ein Chutzal Aret Kedailah. And Chutzal Aret is not fitting for you. And it's interesting, I mean, what does it mean on the surface? In other words, this Chutzal Aret is good enough for Avram. Chutzal Aret is good enough for Yaakov. But you're like a special, carbon. Now, what does this mean? What's the difference, first of all, between a Ola and the other Kabbana? Because that's the analogy. Other sacrifices. Malki Yadiana? No? Okay. Jackie, this is the Kabbana. Parts are eaten by the Kohanim, and some are eaten by the ones who bring it. And the rest, every carbon, certain parts are on the Mizbeach to God. But the Ola, we're not allowed to eat any part of it at all. The Kulola should be all for heaven, so to speak. So, in other words, every other cup means that you partake of it, which means you partake of the physical. And that's most of us, the majority of people. I mean, even if we're ethical. So we're part of this world as well. We're involved in this world. And we utilize the benefits and so forth that we obtain from this world for the sake of serving God. That's the idea, that's the karma. But we have our feet on the ground. But the Ola is something which is purely, in other words, where you've really removed yourself from this world. And you don't derive anything from this world, and all of your energy is involved for the sake of heaven. That would mean, now, translating it to personality, that each of the others was unique. The uniqueness of Yitzchak was that he was a completely metaphysical personality. He was totally involved in the world of metaphysical. He did not partake of this world. What's that? You understand? Now, the difference between the metaphysical, a person that's totally involved in the metaphysical, so will not see certain things that a person on a lower level will be able to see. And the reason for that is, it's interesting, like in the field of psychology, to be a great psychologist, you have to have two, here's what we're talking about, a two intellectual quality. You have to have abstract ideas, you have to have abstract knowledge. But let's say a person only has abstract knowledge, like a great theoretician, knows all of the theories of psychology. Is that enough to make them into a great functioning psychologist? No. What else do you have to have? What's the other element? Intuition. You have to have, in other words, usually, it depends what field you're in. Of course, if you're involved in abstract science, engineering or whatever, so therefore it's mainly the abstract. But when you're dealing with the practical implementation, you've got to know your theory very well, but actually the truth of the matter is that the more important element is the intuitive. You can't just fly intuition, you have to have the fundamental foundation, but in actual day-to-day analysis, working with patients, the intuitive is very important. And the same is true, even like we're talking about lawyers. A person could be a great teacher of law, can be a great scholar of the law. Doesn't mean you're going to want that person to be your lawyer in a case. You'd rather have someone that's not necessarily so sophisticated in every theory, couldn't even explain it well, but has a tremendous sense of how to manipulate, how to operate in the court. Two different things. Now, what we call intuition, to a large extent, when you sense a defect in another person, where does it come from? It usually comes from yourself. It very often what's a sharp insight, when you have a sharp insight into somebody else, and you spot something, it's a hunch, and you follow it through, and it turns out to be true. This person was really involved in some shtick, not what they cracked up to be. So you observe them, they do certain things, and you get a certain feeling, because it triggers off an emotion. You have that same emotion yourself, and you recognize that emotion. Doesn't mean you're not like that, you wouldn't do it, but you know the emotion. Now, once you know the emotion, you can sort of feel it in somebody else. And of course, it takes you have to be intelligent about it. You have to follow it through. It's intelligence as well. But it's intuition and intelligence operating together. And the reason why Yitzchak didn't see it is because he was an old animal. He didn't have these emotions. And that's why, that's the naivete that he had. It wasn't a lack of intelligence. It was simply because he was so perfected that he couldn't identify. And you find the people like that. You find people, you meet like a certain very refined personalities that they can't even imagine. Rav Moshe was like that. You think of a person like Rav Aaron Soloveitchik. They're so on such a high plane that when you talk about people and you accuse them of a certain base behavior, their basic reaction, you can't, like, they always tend to over it. A person couldn't be like that. I mean, they can't even imagine. You can't imagine people acting that way. So he couldn't imagine. I mean, what the other person believes that. Why? It doesn't mean that he prefers a sophisticated Russia to a... the people in Canaan were very base. Very steeped in the base, physical, and instinctual. They weren't in a high sublimate. They weren't sublimated. But the people in the family that he come from were very cultured. So on. So you see, he prefers a cultured Russia to an uncut. That wasn't the point. The point is, though, that there's a greater possibility in that environment to find someone who really partakes of the truth. Because they've been exposed. You see, for example, even in a mafia family, what do they all want? They want acceptance. So they want their children to go to the finest school, right, and to get the best education. It's an ego thing for them. Also, it could very well happen that a person that grows up in a mafia home can discover the true ideas because they've been exposed to it and reject what their parents stand for. Yes, I'm sure it does. I'm sure it does happen. So, but she understood this. She was totally prepared to understand an Asa, the character of Asa. And that's why she was able to see through. That's why she couldn't love. As soon as she said, Verisco had us at Yaakov. She loved Yaakov because Yaakov was the truth. And she didn't love Asa. Even though Asa was her son. Because a person like Rivka, she had decided, cannot love another individual just because of a relationship. Of a biological relationship. It's not enough. A tzaddik cannot love someone who's corrupt. Impossible. A tzaddik cannot love someone who's corrupt. I don't think it's possible, even if it could be their own child. If it's their own child, of course they have a responsibility to that, you know, to the child, and they may go beyond and try to bring them back or whatever, something else. But to really love somebody who's a Russian is impossible. Not for a real tzaddik. So she loved Yaakov. She loved Esau because she was able to see through. Why was she able to see through? Because she had that intuitional element which was lacking in Yitzchak. So that's the essential difference between the two. So you have to assume one thing, that whatever things Esau had done, Esau did not act in any way which would give her open...
Concrete,
right. There was no overt action. That she didn't have evidence. In other words, clearly, if she had evidence that he had robbed, that he had murdered, that he had done something.
There too.
So he must have done, whatever he did very, very secretly. It couldn't be. If she had overt information, which was beyond a doubt, proved that he was a Russian, then he would have gone straight there. But in a situation like she was lost, you'll find yourself in that situation. Because he loved when you'll find yourself very often, like you're dealing with someone that has an attitude. You can even have this in your own family life with regard to children. The difference between you and your husband with regard to a child or an incident. I'm not talking with the child in the Tatic or Russia, but within a limited framework. In other words, when the child is not doing well in school, the father can have one interpretation, the mother can have another one. There's a lot of differences. And you're convinced that your view is right, and your husband has a different view. It's good. Go out, grow, it's a temporary thing. And up to a certain point, you realize you can't prove it. You have to wait. And eventually, the information that you're looking for will come forth, and then he'll admit. Now, that's the situation. That's the situation that she found herself in. He loved Esav. He had his view. He had formulated his opinion of him. And what's he going to say? I feel my intuition. Well, I can't act on the basis of your feelings. Prove what? Give me some facts. Give me some evidence. He doesn't have any evidence. Because everything he did was done very... It's my sense of how he's moving and operating. I can sense it. I know it. But that's not sufficient. Again, as we discussed in Lahavdil, in certain cases, the burden of proof is upon her. He's the Bechor. He's the Bechor. He's entitled. The bracha goes to the Bechor. I can't change around the whole scheme of things because of your... Oh, yes, he said, by Yah, she saw Metachet. She saw him being Metachet. And he didn't deny that. Doing play, but the instinctual, being involved in the instinctual, mischief, she saw. The only machlokas, he didn't deny what she saw. The machlokas was, what to do about it, what the effect would be, whether it would have, that was a difference of opinion. He didn't deny her fact. That was a matter of opinion. What's the best way to handle the situation? Avram held that we could save the situation. We don't have to send him away. Rivka said, no, God decided the issue. But there was no machlokas as to the fact. Here, there were no facts. He has to go by the general criteria. He's a Bechor. He's done nothing wrong. In fact, at least everything I see, he's doing kill. So you're going to tell me about your intuition? She realized there was nothing that she could do. And therefore, she had to resort to this subterfuge. And that explains, as Laurie pointed out, it's only then, after when he realized what had taken place, and he realized that he had made a tremendous mistake. Rashi says when he saw Bayechara, the Rashi, he saw the door of Gehenna opened up beneath him, so to speak. Which means he recognized that he was completely wrong and that he was raising a Russia in his household. That became clear to him at that point. So it could be that he even had Svetos over there. He had doubts yet. And that might explain some more about those Rashi. Right, that doesn't mean to say that there were no doubts whatsoever, but even in his own mind, you can't base your life on doubts. You have to act in accordance with reason. And if it's in reason, right, you've got to make a decision. The fact that you make a decision doesn't mean that you've eliminated every possibility of a doubt, but that's the best decision to make. And once, however, he realized what was going on, it all became crystal clear to him that he was, and to him, what could be worse? What could be more frightening than the realization that he was raising a rush in his own house?
He went back and he said,
that point is clear.
He realized.
He had an entirely new realization.
Exactly. So then another question.
So I start off the first question is, so why later on? When she finds out that Esav wants to kill him, so she tells Yaakov the truth, and then when she tells Yitzchak, she makes up this other story that she goes choose a wife. I would say because she didn't want to hurt him. There was no reason. In other words, her only objective, you see the righteousness of Rivka, she's operating purely on the objective level. She's operating purely from behind the scenes. And everything that she's doing is being done for the sake of achieving the objective without... There was no need. She understood by Yechera. She understood what a painful thing this was for Yitzchak to find out. Now, that would not justify not telling him in the first place. In the first place, she would have had to tell him. My explanation is she didn't tell him because at that point she had no proof. He would not have accepted it. But now that he knew that Esav was a Russia, but that far... that he has to be burdened with his knowledge, that he's planning. The only important thing is to save Yako, and she has to make up something which is plausible so that Yitzhak will understand why he's leaving. He can't just leave without telling Yitzhak why, and to get Yitzhak's blessing. Now, there was another reason why he has to leave. It just so happens he has to find a wife, and that's part of the plan anyway, to send him away to find a wife. So when it comes to Yitzhak, just as they say, you know, you're not allowed to tell a lie, and the truth you don't have to tell. Sometimes it's a great mitzvah to withhold the truth. Just why should he carry this around with him in his mind, this disturbing thought and this fear, right? It'll take away from his thinking, from his learning. She had no desire to do that. Therefore, when it came to Yitzhak, she said, she only used the reason. See, and apparently Yaakov also knew not to tell him the true reason. So he should not be burdened with this now. Funny enough, I think we see, again, a further illustration that, of course, needless to say, the role of women, she's really the, perhaps the key figure in this whole parsha. The amount of control, the amount of influence that she has over the situation, in directing the course of Jewish history, and the manner in which she operates. She operates from behind the scenes. And I made that point in this year, that the fact that you're not out in the forefront does not mean that you don't have a tremendous input into what's going on and a tremendous role to play. Behind the scenes, she's not looking for any type of credit, and everything that she's doing is being done purely for the proper good, and she's a master at bringing about the correct result. She's a master at bringing about the correct result, knowing how to assess the situation. And utilizing here too on the intuitive. If you remember, I said I believe, I quoted the Gemara, that in the area of the intuitive, women are superior intellectually. They have a greater natural ability in the intuitive. Whereas I was saying that purely on a natural basis, men gravitate more towards the abstract. Okay.